Nambu?
No, I don't know.
Nambu? You got it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, my mind. Yeah, he, what was he looking at? He might have been looking at superconductivity and things, but he was talking about spontaneous symmetry breaking. And Hayes and actually a variety of other people. There are quite a few people who were hitting on the idea of the Hayes mechanism in the 60s, I think it was. But it's a simple idea, and in fact, almost every solution to every field equation in physics, as far as every mechanics problem, is breaks the symmetry. Right? I mean, there's, you know, if a problem has some symmetry, a solution probably does not have that symmetry. Okay? I mean, you know, take your favorite mechanics system. You know, let's pull it down. It's solved that way, not that way. But, you know, the action that describes the motion of this thing is cylindrically symmetric. But, you know, if I give it any initial condition at all, it ends up in a non-symmetric solution. General relativity has Poincaré symmetry or Lorentz symmetry. Lorentz symmetry includes rotation. Everything in this room is a solution of general relativity. So is it invariant under rotation? No. You know, it's a solution. It doesn't have to be. So the trick with the Higgs mechanism is to use that natural tendency of equations to break symmetry, to break the symmetry that's responsible for keeping the gauge particles from having mass. So you can write an action that is symmetric under, say, SE2, and have it naturally have solutions. You know, you ease the way for it, right? You put in a potential that really forces it to have some solution that breaks the symmetry in just the way you want, so that effectively still some large class of solutions have been forced into a situation where it looks like particles have mass. This is the technique. And we need this in a couple of different ways. Last time we talked about the strong interaction. And we wrote an action for the FG3 gauging and color, and all that worked just fine. We had our red anti-blue quarks and so on. But there were two things we left undone about the strong interaction. One, we said we're going to leave the weak interaction of the quarks until later. And, okay, that'll be straightforward once we understand how to write the weak interaction. But the other thing is that the quarks have mass. And those masses, each quark has a slightly different mass. They don't necessarily differ by a whole lot, but they're different. And you need to put some way for those masses to be different into your Lagrange. In order to have the SU3 symmetry, remember we've got three copies of the Dirac action, one for each color. Well, those are better all have the same mass, or you don't have an SU3 symmetry. So any differences in the quark masses have to be incorporated in some symmetry breaking mechanism like the Higgs. We could set up the weak interaction, but we're gonna run up against the problem of masses right away. So it looks just like the strong, right? It's the Yang-Hills theory. We've written Yang-Hills actions. So we could write an action that would be the SU2 field strength squared times the quarter plus some Dirac Lagrange densities for the leptons. And we could put things into doublets. Well, those are the ones you usually see, the up-down, the charmed strange top-bottom quark, the electron and electron neutrino, the muon and muon neutrino, and the tau and tau neutrino. Each of those six doublets transforms under SU2. And that accounts in part for the weak interaction. But, let's see. Yeah, rather than going ahead and writing that down, let's develop the Higgs mechanism. So, a simple case first. Let's take a scalar field, and this is just as an example, with a potential. So we've got something like d mu phi, mu phi, only a half. And then for a potential, okay, remember what we said about renormalizability, right? What is it? If we have dimensionless coupling constants, we're okay. But if we need positive dimension coupling constants, length of some positive power, then our renormalization probably won't work. You remember we went through that one day? So you can ask what kinds of potential we can add. Well, we put a Z of phi, but the units of phi, if we have a D4X on our Lagrangian, then the derivatives go like 1 over a length. So the two derivatives together give us 1 over length squared. Here we've got length to the 4. So we expect phi goes like 1 over length as well, because we've got a phi squared here. All right, that makes the action dimensionless. And it tells us what powers of phi we can have. So if we expand Z, imagine a Taylor series, you can have arbitrary powers of Z. Well, a constant doesn't do anything. Actually, something linear doesn't either, but you can stick it in here. Beta phi squared. Some sort of power series to arbitrarily high powers. But now, where are we going to run into problems here with renormalizability? Okay, so phi goes like 1 over length. Here we've got length to the 4th, so alpha has to go like 1 over length. 1 over length cubed, negative power of length, no problem. So where are we going to run into trouble? We get up to phi cubed, that's going to be 1 over length cubed. Gamma is going to have to go like 1 over length, right? We're still okay. Phi 4 is a marginal case, delta is dimensionless, length to the 0, we've got 1 over length to the 4th, so we could have a phi 4th term, but here, we're going to run into problems because sigma's got to go as a positive power of length. And that will be non-renormalizable. So the most general potential we can add goes up to fourth order. Alright, well, there's more we can do here. The odd term, you can probably get rid of by linear transformation. By choosing your coordinates right, if you shift phi by a constant, how much can we get rid of? If we replace phi by mu phi and
plus mu.
You know, for some constants mu and nu, choose mu, nu to get rid of. Find you and find her. Let's see. I'm sure you can get rid of one. You may not be able to get rid of, let's see, what, the linear. Certainly you can do it for the 5 cubed. I'm not sure about that. But, you know, if I take mu naught 5 plus mu naught to the 4th, that's going to be mu naught to the 4th, pi to the 4th, plus, what's the first term here? We get up to like a 4 mu naught cubed pi cubed times mu naught in lower order terms. So choose mu naught cubed mu naught times 4 equals to minus gamma, basically. There's minus gamma over what, mu naught cubed or something. And that will cancel the cubic term. You know, check this as an exercise, see what you can get rid of. You can just redefine your field in some convenient way. I'm not sure if you can get rid of the linear term this way, because if the potential isn't symmetric about the minimum, it's hard to see how you could remove all of the odd stuff.
Maybe you can get rid of, because I know you can get rid of, like in classical mechanics, you know, get rid of linear terms for...
yeah, what do you do?
You do the same thing. Maybe you can't get rid of both of them, though. Maybe if you have a 5 linear and a linear...
Yeah, for sure you can get rid of the cubic. But I'm not sure you can get rid of both the cubic and the linear. So try it. Okay, exercise. You know, how much can you get rid of?
That's always, that's the standard trick with harmonic oscillators always, is to get rid of the linear term. It seems like...
Yeah. Yeah, if you've got an nth degree, you can certainly get rid of the n minus first degree. But I don't know about the linear. Of course, the linear doesn't do anything when you vary it. It adds a constant to the field equation, which, you know, like, what's that? So it's probably not going to do anything in any case. At any rate, this constant doesn't do anything. That contributes, if we can't get rid of it, it contributes at most an additive constant to the field equation. I don't know, shift the eigenvalue or something, maybe. So what we're going to look at then is V of phi is equal to, let's take mu phi squared plus lambda phi. That's the sort of thing you want.
I'm sorry.
In any case. And the interesting thing about this is it allows us to break the symmetry. Now, the symmetry I'm going to talk about for this simple Lagrangian is one that doesn't permit a linear term anyway. So, but the action would be a half d mu phi, plus mu phi squared, let's say we want to subtract the potential here, minus lambda phi fourth. I'm not going to tell you the signs of mu and lambda. I think one of them is we're going to want to make negative. Probably the mu we're going to want to make negative. This potential becomes large for phi large as long as lambda is positive. So let's specify lambda positive. But I think we want mu. Let's just put a minus sign, so we'll take mu positive as well and change that sign. There we go. Okay, those are the signs that will do what we need. Now, this is symmetric under what? What symmetry? Symmetry does it have? We've got Lorentz symmetry.
Yeah, like parity.
Yeah, parity. Yeah. Pi goes to minus pi.
Okay.
Okay. It's a cheap symmetry, but it'll serve. You know, we're going to break that symmetry by the solution. Okay. So, yeah, this is great. And Boo and I were among the first 50,000 people to get Macintosh computers.
Oh.
We used to hang out in the hall talking about Macs.
Do they have those 5.5 drives?
No, it was, what drives did it have? The Mac, I think that was the hard case ones, the 3.25 by then. They were smaller. Now, I had an Apple II Plus before that, and that had the 5.
Oh, okay.
The floppy, true floppy.
I think it.
It's amazing. You know, I mean, my watch is smarter than that computer. Well, okay, that's not saying anything, because my watch is actually my phone, and it's still an Apple. But, anything with any kind of chip in it these days is a lot smarter than those computers. I think that, let's see. Which memory did it have, like 4K or something on the hard drive?
It was a great, it was a mass part.
No, it was, up to 64K of memory. And
a RAM or a total storage?
Let's see, how'd it work?
Apple didn't have hard drives. You had to put
drives had like 128 or something. But the RAM, it had 64K of RAM.
Okay.
No, but I don't think you can buy a chip that small anymore. It's like a, a gigabyte these days?
There was a great ad in the math department in OSU. It was like this advertisement from a computer magazine from the 70s. It was like the newest hard drive had 32 megs, maybe 32, 16 megs of storage space. And it was $3,000 for the hard drive.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I remember when they came out with megabytes. Memory chips. Oh man, that's huge. On one chip, wow. last week Meg bought a 2 terabyte drive for like $200.
Right.
That's 10 gigabytes for $1. It's just insane. We do a lot of different stuff with it now. I mean, now you can do video. It used to be, you can do music, and all before that it was, it can calculate.
I wonder how many terabytes a brain holds. How much memory?
We're actually getting close.
A brain.
Oh, a brain.
Yeah. You know, it depends who, but it's memories and speeds are getting comparable to the brain. I just read something on that recently. I forget what the number was, but it's close. Okay. I'll be way smarter than that very soon.
Andy's waiting for something called singularity, where computers start like programming themselves, writing their own code.
That's the singularity.
Once it happens, they call it singularity, AI,
that's like what's this Malthusian catastrophe, right? With population, there's some formula for population that it came up, population growth, like human population, and the model predicts that the human population will diverge in something like 2022. And now, you know, it's hard to picture exactly how, you know, if you work in a 9-month gestation period, you could actually have the population truly diverge. So, you know, there's something missing from the formula. It doesn't work that way, but the true population is higher than that formula predicts at this point. For the last, you know, decade, it has exceeded the growth rate predicted by the population catastrophe. And so it should be an interesting decade. There's jet missiles or so get to work with those green functions. You hear what Bob was here talking about. He's doing green functions again, because I did it last semester, but saying how environmentally sound they are.
Okay.
The only thing to get dirty is your fingertips. What were we doing? We were probably playing with this Lagrange, right?
Okay.
Well, let's look at this. Right. So, as a function of phi, if we look at V of phi, that potential has minima d phi equals 0 at, let's see, what do we have? Minus, I should have put some constants in that, plus, or like a half and a quarter, I might put in there, phi cubed. And this isn't too hard to solve because the phi comes out. And what are we left with? Minus 2 4 lambda phi squared. So we have its schema at phi equals 0 and its phi equal to plus or minus the square root, and I did get the signs right here, of e over 2 lambda. So that makes sense. What's the value of z at, say, z at phi equals 0 is 0, right? So, yeah, maybe we should have put an additive constant on there, but at any rate, you can see what's happening. It diverges positively for really large phi. So your potential is doing something like this. It's got symmetric minima at phi equal to plus or minus root mu over 2 lambda. And then at phi equals 0, you get a local maximum. So what's going to happen at low energy? You know, the field goes to here, or here, one or the other. So at low energy, phi is going to be about equal to phi plus or minus, let's call this phi plus or minus here. And, you know, you'll get small oscillations around that minimum. So, you know, if the energy is here, then you'll get oscillations around some finite minimum value. And so, if you expand the theory at low energy, you're expanding around one of these points, it's no longer symmetric under phi goes to minus phi. You've broken the parity symmetry. Okay, an easy idea. Nothing complicated here. The real question is, how do we use this to our advantage? Yes, Juan.
How is that that you break the symmetry?
Okay, this symmetry. All right, so if the solution breaks the symmetry. So if we're low energy, let's carry this a little further and I'll make it explicit. Let's expand phi equal, let's say phi plus some new field, what we call it, rho. So, you know, we can do this transformation, and this phi plus will solve the low energy equation. We could do it around the root, but let's just stay on the positive side. So now we can write f. This thing is a constant, so phi plus is root of mu over lambda constant. So this becomes a half d mu rho. This is the thing that depends on position now. And then we have plus mu times phi plus rho squared minus lambda phi plus rho to the fourth. And so we have a half d mu rho plus, well, there's some irrelevant constants. We've got a mu phi plus squared plus twice mu rho squared minus lambda, and then it's a phi plus to the fourth plus four phi plus cubed rho plus six phi plus squared rho squared plus four phi plus rho cubed plus rho to the fourth. And this is not symmetric. Under rho goes to minus rho. Right, so we've broken that symmetry. We've picked up these cubic terms for one thing, and then these constants aren't going to change sign. So we've got several terms here that now change sign if we change rho to minus rho. So the effective low energy action is no longer symmetric.
That's supposed to be rho instead of phi?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Any other rows that should be phi? There's a rho that is a rho, but it looks like a phi. Yeah, I don't know why my rows are getting a little table today. There. Better. Okay, everybody see how that works? So now, how could we use this to give something a mass? Let's try an example. Suppose we have another field in the picture. Okay. Now let F be a half d mu phi d mu phi. What did we have? Plus mu phi squared minus lambda phi to the fourth. Is that it? Is that our potential? Minus the potential. Plus, let's suppose we have, let's stick in another scalar field. Keep it simple. Phi. Or, let's see, let's do a Dirac field, why not? I think it'll work just as well there. So, phi bar, I, d slash, phi. Suppose we have a massless Dirac field, just to spin it up. Now, what I want to do is add a coupling between phi and the Dirac field. So, you know, with some strength, G. So we'll add an interaction between these two. You see what's going to happen? What happens at low energy? All right, well, this first part of the action turns into all this stuff for rho. But that phi is going to become a phi plus rho. So this term will go to g phi plus of the constant psi bar psi. Let's call it minus. Minus g rho psi bar psi. So rho, the particle described by rho still couples to psi. But this term combines with the Dirac action to give phi bar I d slash minus g phi plus psi. That looks like a Dirac particle with mass. The mass is just this term here, m equals g phi plus. So the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs, right, the minimum value of the scalar field phi, gives us a mass for psi. This is how it works. Question. Everybody see how that's going?
Are we taking this last term and expanding it? What are we doing?
Yeah, take the last term. Do this substitution. Let phi be expanded around its minimum. So replace phi by phi plus rho.
Okay. So we're just adding an interaction term? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we've got two fields. We've got, all right, this phi is a Higgs field. Or you can equal them all. But, you know, if they're going to detect a Higgs particle in an accelerator, it's going to be this rho. Right? So what you're really looking at is the particle described by rho to be there. You know, if that's there and it has the appropriate vacuum expectation value, it has the couple right, then you've seen this mechanism. You've seen evidence for this being the basic action. So, putting in two particles, we can change the mass of phi. I mean, phi could have had a mass to begin with, but we could change it by putting an interaction term like this. So, that particular form of an interaction term is called a Yukawa potential. So it's a particular form that will give you a contribution to the mass of the fermion. Now, we didn't set out to give our fermions masses, although this is the way that we're going to end up giving different masses to the different quarks, and for that matter, the leptons. So if you want to give neutrinos mass, you put in terms like this. And, we'll deal with the complications of that later. There are other mixings that you put into those terms too. But so far as giving different masses to the different particles, it's actually Yukawa potentials that give most of the free parameters to the standard model. You had a term like this for every one of those quarks and leptons, and you know you've just added 9, or with the neutrinos 12. Different parameters, g. This g can be different for every one. So you've added 12 new parameters to your model. Well, that makes it like a 20-parameter model by the time you're done. And that's fine. That's not really all that many parameters. So you fix the masses of the particles to be what you measure them to be, and then make other field theoretic predictions of, say, cross-section things, and test those. So, questions on how this works, or anything here so far?
So there's a different field, or just a different coupling constant?
Different coupling constant, right? For each different spinner field, Right. So your quarks and your leptons here, you're going to have allow a different g.
But the phi is in theory the same.
Yeah, the phi then locks it in.
Okay.
Yeah. So they all get the same phi. Now. Yeah.
Sorry. People talk about. So you talk about the mass of the Higgs boson.
Mm-hmm.
How do you give that thing mass? Because you've given mass to the spinners, but how did you give mass to the?
Center of attention. Mu. Mu is like a mass term for phi.
Okay.
Right. So the Higgs is already a massive particle.
So the only
this looks like a mass, and then there's a phi to the fourth interaction, self-interaction in the field.
So there's only one. So Higgs is the only thing that has mass, and everything else is given mass by the Higgs. Is that the idea?
Yeah, you could give all the fermions equal masses if you wanted to.
Okay.
Without the Higgs.
So you start off with the same mass, and then you.
Yeah, and then you know there might be other mechanisms for giving the fermions mass, because you know what you need is. You know, a term that's got five R phi term type things in it. Well, you know, the thing that keeps you from just writing some arbitrary mass term is the symmetry. But if you had some matrix that you know that contracted on a multiplet like this, well. If that matrix is allowed to transform under your unitary groups, your SU3, say, so if you take psi to some unitary, maybe psi b, if at the same time m goes to you know a couple of u inverses. On M, then this will be invariant. So, you know, if you put a term like that in, you know, it wouldn't have to be diagonal. It might mix the different parts. Well, they're mixing things like that anyway. So, you might be able to deal with the fermion mass. I'm not positive whether there's a simple way to define such an M that really respects the symmetry. But you can't use this for the sort of gauge bosons. You really have to have something for the gauge bosons. You can't add a term like that and expect that field to transform inhomogeneously. So the gauge bosons are a very special problem here. The gauge bosons, you can't just put a Yukawa potential. Even that potential would not be gauge invariant for a W or a Z particle. So, let's see what happens with those. Let's back off and look at the electroweak theory. What we have is SU2 cross U1. And I think we wrote down a trial action for this before, right? Anybody remember what we used? G and H, were those our fields? We had a quarter G I alpha beta. Is this it? And then we had an H. And then we have some fermions. And we want to gauge covariant derivative on these fermions. So we have a sum over our various leptons. Phi bar I covariant d slash minus m psi. So far they all have the same mass in order to have the SU2 cross U1 symmetry. This covariant derivative of psi is, of course, a partial, And then we need the gauge field, the SC2 gauge fields, and the H, I think they call them B and BI. So we have something like, I think this is where we had an I over 2 G, one of these was a G prime. I alpha, and then we had our SU2 generators, tau I, acting on psi, and these are doublets, right? These psi, so this psi has to be some kind of psi 1, psi 2. So think electron, neutrino, or up quark, down quark, and then we can couple it this way. So you only need the covariant derivative if you've got a doublet. If you just have a single spinner field, then the SU2 wouldn't couple to it. You wouldn't need this covariant derivative term. And then we also have I over 2 and a G prime, perhaps a hypercharge in here, and then the SU1, or the, yeah, not the SU1, the E1 gauge field. Times the psi. So this would be the covariant derivative for the SU2 cross U1. And we run this down the other day and observed that the gauge particles don't have any masses, and it's very hard to see how to give them any masses. The masses of the fermions are all the same, which isn't quite right. So the question is, can we adapt this spontaneous symmetry breaking mechanism in such a way as to give the gauge boson a mass? And the key is in the kinetic term. A term like this, right? If that kinetic term were a covariant derivative, then there would be a coupling between that psi, the Higgs particle, and the gauge boson. You know, they'd come in there quadratically and linearly, you know, you'd have some terms involving both, and you might try and see what you could do with those. Now, what does psi have to be in order for that to have to be a covariant derivative? It just says here. What's it got to be?
Spinner?
It can be a doublet.
Okay.
It can be a scalar doublet, not a spinner doublet. But it's got to be, you know, it can't be just a scalar under SU2 and U1. It's got to transform tensorially under these, at least as a vector. So we need a doublet of Higgs particles. Yeah. So we need a Higgs doublet. So that the partial mu of phi goes to a covariant mu of phi, and then you're going to have a term like this where you have this acting on the doublet. So this is d mu phi plus same stuff. I'll write it down here too. G d I alpha tau I, then we put our phi here. Now the phi is a pair, right? So phi goes to, you know, it's going to be some phi 1, phi 2, like that. And so now we need this. And it can have hypercharge. Let's choose the hypercharge of the Higgs V minus 1. I've seen different choices of this in the literature. There are probably various assignments of hypercharge to things that will work out, but I did find one concrete statement of a hypercharge minus 1, so I'll set y to minus 1. Then we have g prime, b alpha, and the Higgs doublet there. So now when we write the kinetic term for the Higgs doublet, we're going to have all these quadratic terms in those gauge fields. And when the Higgs takes on a vacuum expectation value, then that value is going to contribute to a constant times the v squared thing that's going to look like a mass for those particles. So let's press on and see how it works. Any questions at this point?
Anybody see where we're headed?
So, why...
why is the charge of the given particle? So, each particle field can be assigned a specific electric charge, a specific hypercharge, and so on.
Why do we have to... this is an this first one was an example. Do we need to do this for SU3, or is it just in this SU2?
No, the gluons are massless, so we do not do this for SU3.
Okay.
Right. So in particular, this phi has no color. Right. Otherwise, it would couple there, and it would give masses to the gluon.
Okay.
So if in 10 years we discover, hey, these gluons have a little bit of mass. Then, just what to do. You make it have color as well. So you'd have SU2 crust U1 weak doublets of each color. Then they would couple to the strong interaction too. And, you'd have lots more things to look for at CERN.
So what are Psi1 and Psi2? Would this be like...
Like the examples, like the electron and the electron neutrino, or like the up and down quark, any of those pairs of those are the SU2 doubles.
Okay.
Now, they're not, as it turns out, they're not weak doublets. SU2 gets mucked up in a couple of ways. So this SU2 cross U1, things look very clean here, but it turns out that the W and V naught and photon are various linear combinations here. And we'll see which combinations when we work out in detail what the masses are. Because three of the electroweak gauge bosons are massless, and one is massless, the photon. So, Stefan, more questions? What are we doing? Joe, you're scowling. You get it?
I won't say that, but...
Okay. But, you have a question? Okay. Let's see. Let's go ahead and expand this out into a half. Oh. But there's a simpler way to do it. We have gauge invariance here. It's fairly hard to choose a gauge to simplify the gauge vectors. But it's pretty easy to choose a gauge to simplify the Higgs delta. So let's pick a gauge. Okay, so we know that the, say, VI alpha is going to go to, it's going to go to G alpha, G inverse, minus DG, G inverse, where G is the exponential of some linear combination of the generators of the whole group, right? So some linear combination of the taus and some linear combination of our single generator, something like that for our hypercharged generator. So, all right. That's a horribly complicated transformation law. We're not going to muck with that one. But under the same transformation, a doublet just goes to G5. It's the rank 1 tensor under the electroweak gauge group, under FE2 cross U1. it transforms as a vector. So this thing is some matrix, right? This is some have I introduced any index that runs from 1 to 2? What do we call it?
Okay.
Yeah, it's like 5, 5, 5, 5. So psi and psi equal 1 and 2, right? So putting in the indices of this matrix, right? These are some 2 by 2 things. That's just a multiplier.
Is G some kind of group element in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. G is an element of
as you do. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, it's something in
there. So these are the same G then, right? On the G5?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So same G. So it's just that, okay, tensors transform simply. You know, these doublets, you know, they're vectors under the group. Okay.
Why does B have different numbers of indices? What is that B?
These two B's?
I.
B I. There are 3 generators for SU2, and the generators are tau. Right, and for each generator of SU2, we introduce a Lie algebra valued one form, a connection. That's this guy. So a one form, it's got one space-time index on it. And there's one for each generator. So these are the gauge fields. These will be the W and C particles. This is the U1 gauge field. There's only one. So I don't need an index here. Right. So this is 4 gauge fields because there are 4 generators for this group.
Okay.
All right, are there other questions? We can take any of this in as much detail as you want to see.
And the G's are just arbitrary constants here, right? Experimentally measured.
Yeah, constants. Yeah, that's our coupling constants. And yeah, we can pull them out of our definition of B if you want. The G and D prime are like the electric charge. In fact, the electric charge can be expressed in terms of those. Other questions? So my goal in picking a gauge is to make phi as simple as possible. And so now we're just going to do an SU2 rotation of this thing. So G phi, so under SU2, I forgot because it's a different class, but you know how to do SU2 rotations. You know, it's just spin or something, right, or whatever. So we can let's do it the way you're used to. E to the I phi over 2 n hat dot our generators tau. Well, you know, tau is just the fully matrix, maybe with a different normalization, I forget. Do we have a maybe the hat is in there? Redefine phi. Let's write it this way. You know how to work with this. Those things are the fully matrices. Is that what did we say was the commutation relation for a tau? Let's do it correctly.
So
I think we had a 1 here. Was that right? Was that what we said? And for the poly matrices, it would be sigma I, sigma j. You have a 2 over here. Oops, sigma. So I'm thinking that tau is equal to sigma over 2. If I put sigma over 2, sigma over 2, and sigma over 2, multiply 2 by 4, I end up with a 2 there. So tau is just sigma over 2. So I just have that in terms of the tau. There's no 1/2 here. That's a different choice of normalization of the generators. Okay, times phi. Phi is a doublet, so we have a phi 1 and we have a phi 2. Well, we know how to write this thing. Okay, we can expand the poly matrices In fact, let me write them as polymatrices. This is E to the I phi over 2 n hat dot sigma phi 1 phi 2. And we know that we can expand the group element for SU2 as the identity times cosine of phi over 2 plus I n hat dot sigma times sine phi over 2. Right? You just write the Taylor series for the exponential, and you figure out what n dot sigma the various powers is. We've been through that a few times before. So we see this identity. And let's see, what if I choose different names of the angle? We will have too many phis floating around otherwise. Let's use theta. Now, this is a rotation in some abstract group space. You know, this isn't, we're not doing spin here, we're not doing, you know, rotations in real tree space. But still, we know how to act with this thing on that column vector. So, what does this look like? G phi is equal to, okay, so that G, I can write as cosine theta over 2. And then we've got an nz here, so we have I times the z component of that vector times sine theta over 2. Then down here, we're going to have the I times nx times the sine theta. Then we're going to have plus I. Okay, sigma 2 has an I down there, so we have ny times I, so we're just going to end up with a minus ny times sine theta over 2. And here we end up with a complex conjugate of that, I think. Let's see, no, it's a minus, sorry, this I is the same, but there's a minus I on the n2 part, so the ny will come in with the opposite. Fine. I n x plus n y. And then the same thing with the minus sign on the z. Okay. If you remember your Pauli matrices, that's what it looks like. And times, I don't have room to put that. All right, that's g. So that's the right phi. So G phi is equal to some two component thing. Well, what is it? It's going to be phi 1 times this plus phi 2 times that and so on. So phi 1 times cos theta over 2 plus I and the sine theta over 2 plus phi 2 I and x plus n y sine theta over 2. And the second component is phi 1 times this stuff, I n x minus n y sine theta over 2 plus phi 2 times that stuff. So it's theta over 2 minus I n z sine theta over 2. So there's our new doublet in a different gauge. So, how simple can we make this? Let's choose the second component, 0. I bet we can do it. So, let's demand, you know, this is going to be some phi 1 prime phi 2 prime, right? So let's see if we can get phi 2 prime to be 0. The SU2 rotated version, get rid of that second component altogether. So take phi 1 and phi 2 to be arbitrary, and then see if by choosing theta and the components of n, we can make this thing simpler. So let's give these things names. Alpha, this is just some complex number, not totally arbitrary, but Because its magnitude is, you know, probably less than one or something. It's certainly bounded. But just for ease of computation, let's just see what happens here. So then what this means is alpha phi 1 plus beta phi 2 has to be, right, that's phi 2 prime, and we're going to demand that that be 0. And that says that we need to choose beta equal to minus alpha phi 1 over phi 2. Well, we have no control over the magnitude of phi 1 over phi 2. So the question is, can we do that? And we can, because we can make alpha as small as we need to. So this gives us beta over alpha, shall we say, has to be minus phi 1 over phi 2. And if we look at beta over alpha, let's see. Yeah, I don't want to erase this action yet. Let me work over here. So let's take a picture of that for you. You've got the two. Okay, so beta over alpha is, what is it? It's cos beta over 2 minus I mv times beta over 2 over sine. Okay, well, this isn't so bad. Let's see, if we let mz equal 0, that's going to give us cosine over sine is theta over alpha equal to cotangent of theta over 2. Now, cotangent takes on arbitrary magnitude. So then we have that divided by an arbitrary complex number here. This is, we don't have control over the magnitude of this, but by choosing theta, we can make the magnitude anything we want. We can get the phase to be anything we want here, so we're good. We can do it. Does everybody see that? Or should we solve it exactly? Okay, so we're demanding that this be some unknown number minus phi 1 over phi 2. Phi 1 over phi 2 is an arbitrary complex number. So we have to be able to choose theta and nx and ny so that it's equal to some arbitrary complex number. Well, I claim we can do that. You see? Okay.
Okay. No.
All right. So we don't need to work out the exact choice. We still have some freedom here. We've chosen theta, but all we've really chosen for nx and ny is the ratio. So we still have mz, we still have the magnitude of either nx or ny. They have to be less than 1, so we don't have an arbitrary choice there, but we can do this. So let's see if we can do some more. All right. Phi 1 prime is equal to what is the top line over there. So this number is the complex conjugate of that one. I took beta to be that, so this is going to be beta bar, or beta conjugate, times phi 1, plus, and then, let's see, what do we get? I and x, so it's actually minus the complex conjugate of alpha times phi 2. So let's see, what is that? We've chosen. Let me pull out beta bar. Let's see, and write this as phi 1 minus alpha bar over beta bar phi 2. And from here, we see what beta over alpha is. Beta over alpha has to be that number, which is determined. So this is some, well, beta over alpha has to be minus phi 1 over phi 2. So this is beta bar times phi 1 minus becomes plus, and then alpha bar over beta bar is phi 2 bar over phi 1 bar times phi 2. So, continuing, phi 1 prime is equal to, let's call it beta bar over phi 1 bar conjugate. Then we have phi 1 bar plus phi 2 phi 2 bar. Well, since beta is limited in magnitude, right, beta is just this number here, we're locked in on theta. We've already picked theta. So we just get to choose NZ. So basically, we're choosing a phase here. So what we can do is choose theta so that, right, this is real. This phi 1 bar just has some phase. So what we can do is choose phi 1 prime to be real. We can get rid of the phase. Everybody convinced, or do you want an exercise?
Oh, exercise, not convinced.
Where's the prime? I see.
What? Oh.
Any bar or something? Or wait.
What's the question?
Where's the prime in the expression?
Here.
Oh,
I'll
okay. Oh, okay. Okay.
Right, that's the new component. The new component.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So exercise. Do this carefully. Those four real numbers in such a way as to make almost all of phi go away. You reduce it to one real number. This makes things a lot simpler to choose this gauge. You know, and so instead of these doublets, you know, things are going to reduce down to single terms when we square that covariant derivative. This is a standard gauge. Sometimes you see V in the second component. V is even the symbol people often use for the parameter. But one real parameter is not determined by gauge. That's the essential content of the Higgs double. So, questions? So you're not convinced. But should I clarify some more of this? I think I did it differently in the notes. Check my notes because I went through this. What did I do? You get a relationship between beta and alpha from the first one. So, essentially, alpha is determined by beta. You substitute into the second one, and then you still have beta to choose, only the magnitude is limited. The first choice, you're okay on magnitude. You can always make it work. So, this isn't a hard thing to do. You can... Good practice. But if you want any clarification of what I'm doing, good time to ask.
think one thing that I'm questioning is if phi and phi 1 and phi 2 are in general functions of space. So how is it two constants can...
Local gauge symmetry. We get to do this at every point differently.
Okay.
Right. We have gauged the group. So remember, we created a fiber bundle with SU2 at every point.
Okay.
So do the same calculation now at each point of space-time.
And it'll be different theta and alpha.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Five of field.
Okay. Five of field. And so we're basically...
Yeah. So theta of x, you know, theta and n hat are the real parameters of the group. It's a local action of the group. So theta and n hat are different at every point, too.
Okay. That was a big thing.
Yeah, well, that's important to understand. I didn't mention that in my notes.
Okay.
But, yes, we have local symmetry, so yes, we can do this at every point. Are there other questions here?
How is beta bar over phi 1 bar real? Is that real?
Beta bar over... We're free to choose beta.
Oh.
Right. That, basically, the first condition determines alpha in terms of beta. You know, think of it that way. So, for the second condition, we're allowed to choose... We can still choose beta to be anything. Since we don't have control over the magnitude of beta, the best we can do is choose it for the phase. The phase of beta cancels the phase of phi 1 bar.
Okay. Okay. So choose to be the same, are you saying?
Yeah, just choose them to have the same phase. Choose beta.
Okay, so
it has
the same phase. So it becomes a 1. It becomes a 1 then. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So,
oh.
And then, you know, there's some amplitude there, but that doesn't matter.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, you know, another way to see this, you know, you can argue this in one sentence, basically, right? You know, what defines SU2? SU2 is the group that preserves a Hermitian norm on some two-dimensional complex space. It doesn't preserve anything else. So what does it preserve? Exactly that phi 1, phi 1 bar plus phi 2, phi 2 bar. That's all that SU2 is going to preserve. So there's one real number that is essential to find, and anything else is up for grabs from the SU2 rotation. I'm sure you can do this calculation much cleaner than what I've done up here. It's pretty good. Here's the equation over here. Right? You want the new phi 1 and phi 2 are given by this rotation where the three components of n other than being a unit vector are arbitrary and theta is arbitrary. So just find theta from n that make phi 2 prime 0 and phi 1 prime real. You can do that. It's just an algebra. I don't know why it came on meter in the notes. Probably because I was working backwards. We should just do it again. It would come out really clean. Try it at home. A nice exercise. Okay, so the claim is then that we can choose a gauge so that the Higgs field takes the form V0, the Higgs doublet, where V is real. And let's substitute that back into our action over here. So let me modify the action. The covariant derivative of the Higgs is going to be this. Let's leave that. So we're choosing a gauge where this is V and 0. Everything else changes too, so put primes on everything. But we don't care how it changes because we didn't know what it was anyway. So now, do those changes, the Higgs becomes that, now drop the prime. And it looks just like it did before, only the fields are different than the ones we didn't know. Now, we want to modify the I don't mean this for the leptons. What I need is to add the covariant derivative of the Higgs field. And it's complex, so it will be a d dagger like this. But in fact, it's real, so that'll go away again. So we have that, and then we add our Higgs potential. Might as well add the same thing as before. Actually, there's a simpler way to add the Higgs potential. What we want to do is we want to apply this transformation not to the whole Higgs field, but to the minimum of the potential. So when phi is at a minimum of the potential, we'd like it to be this. And then we can add rho in general. One real field. So let me say it again. Yeah, do this for the whole Higgs field. We're left with one real field. We expand that field about a minimum of the potential. So yeah, let's call this. What do I want to call this? Eta. Let's call that eta, where eta's real. So that's the field, but then I want to expand around a minimum of the potential. So let V be the minimum of the potential and rho the expansion, like that. So we want to arrange so that this constant V is the minimum of the potential. The easiest way to do that is to write the potential as the norm of phi squared minus V squared times the norm of phi squared. Let's see, if we do that, does that do it? So let's just check. So if this is V of phi, then dV e phi. Alright, so this becomes this is just going to be eta to the fourth minus V squared eta cubed. Now we're not quite at the minimum. Let's see, we probably need, if we put a quarter here and a, I know how to do it. Let's take norm of phi squared, that's just phi dagger phi minus e squared. Like that adds a constant to the action, that doesn't do anything. So the V to the fourth is a constant. So if that's the potential, then the minimum occurs when the derivative of that and e squared times the derivative of this is 2 eta equals 0. So we have a minimum when eta equals 0. This is just eta squared minus v squared. So the extrema are at eta equals 0 and plus or minus v. There. Everybody see it? So it's just a clever way to write the potential. So we plant the extrema at plus or minus b. Okay, now let's write out what happens to the gauge boson. How are we doing on? Oh, we'll have time.
So what are we taking the derivative with respect to on this one over here? Sorry.
Let's step phi. Okay. Eta. This is just eta squared here. So if we put in the field, so we're finding the minimum of v with respect to the field eta. It only depends on one, so it's easy. So it's really the same potential we wrote before, plus a constant.
So if B is eta, if D is eta, and everything.
C. C is, C squared is eta. Right. When I write C squared, that's C conjugate. C is, it's just the norm of this thing. That's eta conjugate eta is just eta squared because eta is real.
Right. Okay.
So, and then just find the extreme of the potential. Question?
I have a dog team. This gene matrix.
Yeah.
Must be complex conjugate.
I erased what it was. What? Where did I use the conjugate? Right, this is, I'm just writing out 1 cos theta over 2 plus I n dot tau n dot sigma sine theta over 2. Yeah, the I ends up on the n because we've got this extra I here. Right. Remember, sigma x is just 1, 1. Sigma y is minus I and I. So sigma y, this I makes it real here and puts the sign. And then n x is just 1 and 1, so you get the I coming in with n x. But
and just talking to the minus in the
If I write, suppose I write some vector w dot the Pauli matrices, then that is going to be wz and minus wz. And then here you'll have wx plus I wy. And here you have wx minus I wy. You're probably used to that.
Mm-hmm.
If I multiply this by I, then it looks funny. So the z part gets an I. You see where it's coming in? So it's this extra I that's throwing you off. Further question?
I have a question. Well, okay.
Yeah.
If we had chosen U1 instead of SU2, would it have been the 2x2 matrix with e to the I phi on diagonal? Is that right?
Well, that would be a two-dimensional representation of U1.
Right, because this is a doublet, though, that's what I'm saying. So to multiply g times phi, would have to be that way.
Yeah, you just multiply both of them by a base for U1.
Okay, but it's the same phase, right?
Yes, okay. That's right. Actually, so we could use U1 to remove that phase. If theta hadn't given us enough freedom here, we could have used the U1. I don't think we need it. I think the SU2 is enough.
Okay.
But, yeah, so, there's still a gauge freedom that'll leave that form invariant. Because, we probably have some control over the norm of beta. But, I explore that. Yeah, you could do a U1 transformation of this also. And it would just be multiplying everything in phi, in fine.
Okay.
Phi 1 and phi 2 by a phase. That's right. Yeah. Okay, other questions? So the thing I want to do is expand this around the minimum. So I basically want to evaluate this expression at the minimum of the Higgs. And then, of course, we get all sorts of road terms. And that's dynamic. That's some dynamical field that they're trying to measure is the LHC. Okay. So, here we go. You got pictures of everything you want? Okay. I probably didn't solve for that in the most elegant possible way. I just want to get it. but calculations look elegant about the fourth or fifth time. You know, before that, you can sketch it. Okay, so with that, dmu psi Sanger dmu phi at the minimum. Have those terms, and added to those we'll have other terms that will involve derivatives of this row and the powers of the row and some complicated Lagrangian of the row, but this part is what we hope will contain mass terms for the gauge boson. So let's expand it out. So, yeah, of course, that's just the row. Let me, let's see, any reason to write those? Just as a placeholder, let me put it in. Then we get the complex conjugate here, so minus I over 2, G, B, I, alpha. Tau I. Acting on phi, okay, so this is now acting on G and 0. And then minus I over 2 G prime G alpha and G 0. Dagger, if you like. Wait a minute, let's see. So I want to dagger this whole thing, right? Except I conjugated. What else happens? The tau's are going to be on the opposite side. So when I dagger this, I've got G0 tau I there. These are just multipliers. And these are real. Why are the B's real?
Choice.
It's the gauge group. They're the real parameters that we exponentiate in the gauge group, right? So yeah, the generators have to be anti-Hermitian, and then for an infinitesimal transformation, you take a real linear combination of those anti-Hermitian generators. So the gauge fields here are real. Okay, same here. And you know, I guess that's going to be a dagger. It's real, but it becomes a row if we're thinking of row column stuff. And then we'll have another one, D and U. Row. I'm dropping those at the minimum. Let me see if that's... Yeah, that's not going to harm anything to drop that at the minimum. It's still there, but it's in another part of the Lagrange. So we just have to square this stuff. I over 2 G B I alpha up tau I D 0 minus I over 2 G prime D alpha. A, C. little bit about that. Now I think we're okay here. So we're going to get this first term norm squared. So we'll have 1/8, a half here, and half there. Then I minus I and I. We have a g squared, d I alpha, d, let's see, let's make that a j. J alpha. So the Lorentz vectors are summed, and then we've got d 0 tau I tau j d 0. So we have to work out that sandwich. Then we're going to have some cross terms minus g g prime over 1/8. B alpha, D, J alpha, D, 0, tau J, D, 0. And I think we had two terms like that. The first with the last should look just the same as that. It's a tau sandwiched between the two Higgs fields. A dot product between the two different gauge fields, a GG prime, and the same sign. So we get two of those. So let's just make that a 4. And then finally we get plus 1/8 G prime squared, the alpha squared, and go ahead, 8 unit product is G squared. Okay, so the constant terms from the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs give us these terms in addition to kinetic stuff and potential. Everybody with me here? Okay. So, there's a mass term. You know, that looks... Because G prime and B are constant. Right. That's the vacuum expectation value there. So, we have a term that looks like a mass term for B, except that it's coupled in here. We're going to have to diagonalize something. Let's work out what this looks like. Alright, that's, for tau x, what do we get? Yeah, it's just a polymatrix over 2 or something, right? So, what happens if we sandwich sigma x 1/1/0/0 with B 0, B 0.
Just 0.
A 0, yeah. Okay, so key point. If I make it I minus I.
So
0. Okay, and what's the last one?
1 - 1.
Sigma z is diagonal, so you get a contribution. Okay, so there's just one term here, so we only get one of the SU2 generators. Let's pass the photon, guys. This is the mixing that gives us the xenon and the photon. So this term, we only get a v squared, and we only get it when j equals 3. What's this one? Okay, now this is pretty easy because it's symmetrized, right? This is symmetric in IJ because it's just a contraction of the same thing. So it's the symmetric part. What do you get for the anti-commutator of a pair of polymatrices? It's a Clifford algebra.
2 times the symmetric.
Yeah, times the symmetric. So these are polys over 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to get a half times the chronic for IJ. Is that the right factor?
2.
So we know sigma I,
yes,
sigma j is 2 delta IJ of I epsilon IJK sigma k. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I put a half Then I need 1 over 4 here, and I need 2 there and 2 there. And now it's for the tau. So tau I, tau j is 1 half delta ij plus 1 half epsilon ijk tau k. And since this is symmetric in ij, it kills the epsilon, and we just get a half chronicer. So all of this becomes g squared, let's see, over 16. Then we have a chronicer on the d, I alpha d I alpha. That's nice, that's d squared stuff. Then, let's see, I built in the half, and then we have a b squared. And then the cross term, we have minus g d prime over 4, and b alpha b 3 alpha. So just that third component. And then we get a b squared from the cross term. And then finally we have g prime squared b squared over 8 b alpha b alpha. And now, let's separate these out into two different pieces. We have a b squared over 16. I may be off by some factors of 2, so check the notes on this. I'm not remembering like the 16 from the notes, so take a look. So the essential method here is correct. Let's write this as b1 alpha plus b2 alpha. So two of these just come in squared, and then I'm going to separate out the b3 because there's some mixing between b3 and just the plain b. So then we have g squared over 16 b squared times b3 alpha minus g prime over 4 b alpha b 3 alpha b squared, and then g prime squared b squared over 8 b alpha b alpha. Mild concern about the constants. Let's see if this thing factors. So this is given a mass to two of the particles. It's given equal masses to two of the particles, and in fact, let's look at those. Let W plus or minus alpha be defined as B1 alpha plus or minus I B2 alpha. Then plus alpha W minus alpha is equal to, take the product here, the same times as the conjugate, that's going to be B1 alpha squared plus B2 alpha squared. So we have a mass term, B squared over 16 W alpha conjugate W alpha. All right, this is just the same times as conjugate. Those are real fields. So this is a W plus and minus. Right? These gauge fields become the positively and negatively electrically charged W gauge field. And the mass of the W is then equal to, it'll be the square root of this thing, G over 4. So we've given a mass to the W part. Now, let's let let's let G prime. Which way does this go? Yeah, they didn't get a chance to print it down. Let me try and make it through. I forget which way it goes. G post theta is W. If one of these is post theta times the other. So we're just going to define an angle for convenience here. And if we do that, then we can factor out the G squared times V squared. We can factor out, I'd like to factor out an H, but we seem to have an extra root 2 floating around. Can anybody see an error by a factor of 2? This should look like a perfect square. And it doesn't quite.
So V squared.
Let's see, if I had G prime, if I replaced G prime by G prime over 2.
The three matrices that we did over there, we got 0, 0, and V squared.
Yeah.
There's a half in there that we didn't pull out.
So this could be 8?
Right, because tau is... Because we did it with polys, but the polys... But I don't know the
right.
Lattice at all, but...
Okay.
There's a mistake.
Alright, how about the last one? That sure looks like an 8, now I was happier before. let's see. How about the B alpha, B alpha? This is right here, right? Or was it? Hang on. This is, okay, those two squares, we get a quarter. But then we have that half, would have been an eighth.
There's two of them.
And there's two of them to give a quarter, okay. Oh, and then this one is an eighth. All right, and there's no polymatrix in that, is there? So that's not going to give us a 2. But then, in this replacement, you're saying that should be an 8 there. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Because there's one poly. One tau becomes a poly. Okay. So. Ooh. An 8 of them is the one that's exactly the one thing that I can't fix. Let's see. All right. What if we let's rescale the alpha. Let's see. What would help there? No, nothing for it. Yeah, we've got a coefficient off. I think it's right, isn't it? So let's look at what happened. So the B3 alpha, the alpha term. I'm going to write what we should be getting. We have G squared, B squared over 16. Oh, let's see, is this? B3 alpha. And then it should be B alpha times times the cos theta. It should be this thing squared. And it's not quite. So let's see, we need another half on the last term. And then the 8 here would be fine, but we need another half on the last term. Right. I'm not sure if we could change g prime, you know, put like a 1 over square root of 2, but that's going to throw off the middle term then. So I'm not seeing where the half is. We can put this half, you know, next time. But let's tell the story and not worry about the factor of 2 right now. Notice that there is one linear combination of these. You know, I'm thinking we might want tangent here. If we put tangent theta, then if I pull out a cosine theta here, then I need a cosine theta here and a sine theta there. And I believe that's what I want. So it's just a rotation between the two fields. And it's easy to write down the orthogonal in your orthogonal combination. It's going to be B alpha 3 sine theta plus B alpha cos theta. We identify that with A alpha. And we identify D naught with this field. And you see that this combination does not occur at all in this expression. It's independent of that. So this combination does not acquire a mass, the photon. This combination does acquire a mass, so D3 cosine theta minus D alpha sine theta. Theta W is called the Weinberg angle. This comes from the Weinberg Salam unification of electromagnetism and the weak interaction, or QED and the weak interaction. So the mass of the Z naught is going to be GV over 4 cos theta. So we see that the mass of the W over the mass of the Z is predicted to be exactly cosine theta Weinberg. And that is now the definition of the Weinberg angle from experiment. You compare the W mass to the Z mass. It's about 80 GeV over 90 GeV. So the Weinberg angle comes out being around 30 degrees, something like that, 20, 28 point something. Check the particle data group pages to see what the best values for those things are now. But this is now the photon field, the B naught field, and the W field from the electroweak model. It comes from giving the mass with the Higgs. Identifies which one's the photon and what the relationship of the masses of the other ones are.
So this other arrow should predict the mass of the Z naught or something, given one of these two?
Yeah, or depending on what's easiest to measure,
okay.
Right? If from some independent measurement you can measure, say, the Weinberg, then you've predicted one of these masses in terms of the other, yeah. In fact, I believe now it's done the other way around. This parameter is determined by the ratio of this, because these two can be measured very accurately. They're resonances in an accelerator. You know, you put the energy right on that resonance and you get very good data for the mean mass here. So, you know, those masses are known to, you know, several significant figures. Given in the notes. So check the PDF. This is all online now.
So was one mass predicted before the other one? Do you know?
No, they're predicted by this theory. The,
right,
you know, the
right.
ratio is predicted by this
right,
theory.
Right.
Well, and notice that it's the relative coupling constants of the two basic interactions we're starting with. So, you know, you might measure G and G prime, you might measure Theta Weinberg, you might measure these masses, but the others are predictions. Right? Once you measure, you know, one or two of these parameters, the others are all determined. And I would have to check to see which measurements were actually made first. But I believe the V-naught mass was predicted from the theory, because you could do experiments at low energy and determine these other parameters. So you predict the V-mass and you go out and look, and you know everybody was racing to 90 GeV to try and be the first to see the V-naught. Of course, now it's horrendous background for these TED machines. Because you know, you get V-naughts all over the place. They're a problem. you know, because it's uncharged, you can produce these things pretty abundantly. So you do a particle antiparticle solution, and yeah, you can get V naught out. So other questions? This is a true triumph of unification. Okay, this is every bit as important to unification as Maxwell, bringing electricity and magnetism into one clear, unified formalism, predicting the speed of light. This predicts countless accelerator measurements to many significant figures. For example, you know, the theory predicts the decay width and the half-life of these particles, as well as just their basic properties, right? We've done decay rate calculations. Mm-hmm. Well, you can do those. You've got the whole series here. So you go into the quantum field series, you calculate the rate you expect these particles to decay, the explicit curve, bam, right on. So, you know, this is a real theoretical coup. And when the V-naught was detected in around 1980, both Weinberg and Coulomb shared the Nobel Prize. Of course, it's one, you know, every other day there's a Nobel Prize or something. Current stuff. Okay. All right, so, Nobel Prize today.